always tear up when the Grinch's heart grows 3 sizes.
Tears seem appropriate. Enlargement of the heart muscle or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a serious disease which could lead to congestive heart failure.
La 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 la.
I always love when they tell you to drink 8 to 10 glasses a day. Who could drink 8 to 10 glasses of water? Hey, man, what are you doing? Want to go to a movie? A movie? I wish. I'm booked. What are you doing? I'm drinking water like you should be, pal of mine.
It's ghost sickness.
Ghost sickness?
Yeah.
God, no.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that is.
Well, you're that girl that got hooked on pills and then dropped out. You're little Annie Adderall.
And you are a stupid jock who lost his scholarship by dislocating both shoulders in a keg stand.
Keg flip. They're very hard to pull off.
3:10. It's Wednesday, and Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's time for the Wednesday house call, and every single phone line is available right now, folks, if you have a health-related question for Dr. Dworkin. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 is a free phone call if you're on the Bell Mobility System, and toll-free anywhere in North America at 1-800-580-CFRA. And welcome back.
Thank you.
You're feeling better?
Getting better, still not perfect, but...
You're not at 100%, but mercifully you at 80%, that's like most people at 100% anyway.
Thank you very much.
So, that's good. It's great to see you.
good to see you too.
You were preempted last week because...
Well, I'll give the Pope a pass this time.
they had elected the new Pope. And I was saying to some people in the building, I don't know what it is with Dr. Barry and popes, because the last time Dr. Barry was preempted was when Pope John Paul passed away.
Right.
And then you were preempted for the election of Pope Francis.
Right.
But welcome back.
Thank you.
As you know, every time there's a major injury to my Ottawa Senators, yes. I have to ask you about it. Sports injuries. Milan Mikolic has had a history of knee problems. He, a few years ago in 2010, underwent major knee surgery for a reconstruction of what is known as the ACL.
Right.
Now, he underwent arthroscopic surgery this week on the same knee. I don't know what that says, but to clean up debris, and they say this isn't season ending. In fact, he may very well be back in a few weeks.
Right.
So what do you think is going on as someone who has had surgery on both knees over the years? So.
Well, arthroscopic surgery is when they use a scope to look inside the knee. And they usually and when they say they're cleaning up the knee, it usually will refer to the fact that there is some cartilage damage or meniscal damage. The meniscus is literally the cushion between the two bones that form your knee joints, from your upper leg and your lower leg.
Okay.
And sometimes what happens is that the edges of this cartilage get frayed.
Okay.
And when they get frayed, as you bend your knee, it's like having a piece of paper that has a little cut at the end of it, and the flap, it just keeps moving back and forth. And if you keep doing that, it continues to tear. Right.
He tried to play with it, actually. Yeah. He would try to play, and the pain would be too much,
right.
And they'd rest him, and he would come back. And
yeah, and so what's happened is that he either has that kind of tear where when you move the knee, it pulls and it hurts, or some of that has actually broken off and is floating around inside the knee.
Right.
And so when you move and bend your knee, it gets caught in the joint.
Okay.
And starts to hurt. So with the surgery, it actually is very straightforward. And
right.
They go in, there's a little camera, they try and isolate the area that's damaged. They then will either use a little rotary sander.
Okay.
And it'll remove some of the frayed edges, or they'll cut away some of the edges, or they'll use something to vacuum up the debris that's in there to take that out. But the nice thing about arthroscopic surgery is that if you're not doing any major reconstructive effort inside the knee, which is in this case, you do recover very quickly. Within a few weeks, you can resume function. I mean, the knee is a bit swollen because
you've
stuck
something into
it. You'll
have to rehab or do some kind of physio or what have you. I mean, he has the access to the best trainers in the world.
He'll do
of
the
course,
physio. The advantage is, though, is that the knee does not have to be immobilized. So he won't lose the muscle mass. You know, you get muscle atrophy from significant knee surgery, and that's what also contributes to the extended time that is required to recover. In this case, he's likely walking on his knee after the surgery, same day.
The fact that he is a world-class athlete, is that beneficial for him? His recovery might be shorter than the average
person? Sure, it confers a significant advantage. He has not only the cardiovascular capacity to work and rehabilitate, but his leg muscles are already very strong. So, and they're not going to they're not going to atrophy or decompensate on him after the surgery. As I said, usually with the arthroscopic surgery, you're walking right afterwards. Right.
I mean, the playoffs don't start till the end of April. Yeah. So
he should be fine. If all it is just to clean out some debris, he should be pretty much fine to continue playing.
I love it. Great stuff. Okay. Let's go to Dave in Ottawa. Dave.
Good day, Dr. Ray Dworkin. I've actually never had the chance to call in. But, hey,
sure.
It's more of a personal question. You guys are talking about physical activity and things like that. You're a doctor. I'm going to ask you about supplements. When people are trying to get physically active and they're trying to, you know, look good, to go to the gym, like hop on the treadmill, do you recommend any supplements? Some people take whey protein. Some people take creatine, beta alanine, whatever.
We're losing
you, Dave. I'm going to put you on hold, Dave, and you can listen on.
Yeah,
on
I think the gist of it is that whether you need to use supplements if you're going to go to the gym to either tone up or improve your muscle mass or improve your endurance and exercise capacity. I've looked this up extensively, and the British Medical Journal published a 7-part series late last year on how effective. They looked at all the evidence and tried to find evidence to find out whether this was actually beneficial. And the results are pretty equivocal. There isn't much to say that for the ordinary person that goes and exercises, that taking protein supplements or other supplements confers a benefit. There are some instances where they've done very small studies to look at the effect on muscle mass when you go to the gym and you lift weights. But you were dealing with, in this case, there were small studies, what, 16 men. They were younger, in their 20s, and they were already doing a lot of working out. So the question is, how much of that was secondary to the weights that they were lifting versus the supplements? And they found that there was very little change in that. It's very expensive to purchase supplements, especially the protein powders. Are you going to do yourself harm by having a small amount of protein powder or whey with on your cereal in the morning? Probably not. I mean, it's not going to do something where you're going to cause yourself harm. But the issue becomes one of expense and are you getting value for your money as opposed to using the money to buy better quality food. And you're better off buying the food as opposed to the supplements because the food, as in fruits, vegetables, fresh chicken, fish, those will confer a lot more nutrients just in terms of what constitutes real food as opposed to using the supplements. So the short answer is, I don't usually recommend supplements to my patients if they come in and say, I'm going to be doing exercise. I'd rather them just do the exercise and eat well. And your body will respond to that those stresses because that's what the exercise does. Your bodies are very good at responding to that. And for most people, you're not looking to bulk up and become huge. And frankly, those that become really huge are not doing it from supplements. They're doing it from steroids.
Terry is up next in Canada. Terry. Hello, Terry.
Good afternoon.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
I've been recently diagnosed with advanced degenerating disc disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know, well, what is it and how common is it, first of all?
Degenerative disc disease is very common. It's a wear and tear injury, and it usually occurs over time. That is, depends on what someone has done in their lifetime. The discs are the spongy cushions found between each of the bony vertebrae in the spine.
Okay.
So they act as shock absorbers. And what tends to happen over time, and in fact happens to most people as they get older, especially in the quite elderly, is that those discs shrink and they lose water content, they wear down, and over time that cushioning effect between the bones fails, and you then have the bones rubbing on each other as you move and try and bend, which can be quite painful and also very restrictive. Unfortunately, there isn't much that can reverse the process of that damage to those cushions or the discs. They are, ultimately, we try to help people control pain and actually try to keep people as active as possible because especially if you have a joint where the bones are in contact or it's stiffer, if you don't use them, they get even more stiff and more inflexible. And as a result, you have more pain. So the idea is to try and stay as active as possible and to manage pain from various modalities. But usually you tend to see it. A lot of people get them in the neck or in the lumbar spine. As you get older, it's in the thoracic spine. They call it degenerative disc disease, but it's not necessarily a disease process. It's more a process of aging and use overuse as opposed to some disease entity affecting those discs.
Okay. I've been very athletic over my life. Could that have had something to do with it?
Yes. Any activity, when you look at anybody who's been really heavily involved in sports, will either experience, in this case, it could be the degenerative disease in the back. It can be knee injuries. It can be hip injuries. Shoulder injuries.
You look at Major League Baseball pictures, they always need a rotator cuff surgery, for example.
So it is a wear and tear. You'll see that also people who, carpenters and electricians and masonry people, people that are lifting and moving and carrying and constructing will end up with these kind of injuries as well because it does take a toll over time.
So I should continue to do some exercise, or
yes, you should. You should, to the best of your ability, and with as much comfort as possible, to stay as active as possible. Because again, not doing things and cutting back not only will affect quality of life, but it will also make the spine stiffer and more difficult to move around.
So stay active.
Stay active.
Okay, we'll take one more call. Naomi in Canada. Hello, Naomi.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Dr. Dwarf.
Hi.
I'm calling about bronchitis.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a bad dose of it, and I was on a medication for 5 days, which ended last Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that it's supposed to keep working for a while in the body after it's finished. But I still have such a dreadful cough.
Mm-hmm.
It's so bad, and a lot of mucus still coming, that it's almost making me vomit at times. And I didn't know if I should be concerned about that and see my doctor again, or if that's just the way this thing goes.
Well, bronchitis is sort of a catch-all phrase, right? It's a term that's used. All it means is inflammation of the bronchi, and the bronchi are the large tubes that run from your throat into your lung.
Yes.
And there are different mechanisms, different ways of those airways or bronchi to become inflamed. And the most common one are viral infections. And those will not respond to antibiotics. They cause a pronounced cough. It's something that I'm going through right now as well after my cold. It's now 2 weeks into it, and I get these spasms of coughing that are difficult to control. But there's no antibiotic that's going to help calm that down. And most of the time, 14 out of every 15 times that someone comes in with bronchitis, it is viral. And so an antibiotic will be absolutely useless.
Okay.
If an antibiotic works for a cough, especially if it's a bacterial infection, pneumonia and such, you see quite a dramatic turnaround within a few days. So someone that is a smoker tends to will be more likely to have a bacterial infection because they have pre-existing damage. But non-smokers, they get viral infections. They cough for a bit. They can cough for several weeks. And usually what we give is an inhaler, the same thing that we would give an asthmatic, to help control that coughing because it's a spasm or irritation of the airway. So, excuse me. So the antibiotic that was given likely didn't do too much for you.
Okay. We have to stop here, and we'll pick it up after the news.
So my wife said I should get my hearing checked. So we went to a place to do that. They put me in a booth with headphones on. There's a glass partition. My wife and the hearing technician are on the other side of the glass. The guy through the headphone says, "You're going to hear words electronically through the headphones. When you hear a word, let us know what word that is, and that's how we can check your hearing. Ready to go?" "Yeah." "All right, here we go. Here's the first word." "I didn't hear anything." "We didn't start yet." "All right, here we go. Here's the first word. Ready?" "Chamaschutka." "What do you want from me?" "What word was that?" "Was it Chazamahazamah?" "No, I'm going to say Chamahazamah." "No, put me down for Chimahaza Chazahamaza." "No, no, no. What word did that sound like?" "It didn't sound like a word."
Oh, I've been there. 340-580-CFRA. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It is the Wednesday house call, and let's get back to the phones. Alan has one of the most common questions that we get here on the Wednesday house call, shingles. Alan.
Oh, I'm sorry to be repetitive.
No, a lot of people suffering from this.
Well, good afternoon, Dr. Dwork, and good afternoon, Rob. I wanted to ask you about the effectiveness of the vaccine. I believe it's called Zostavax.
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 Right.
And can you tell me, is there any correlation between having a severe case of chickenpox as a youth and your chances of getting shingles, or having a minor case of chickenpox as a youth and your chances of getting shingles?
Sure. Zostavax is essentially a souped-up chickenpox vaccine that we give chickenpox vaccines to kids, and it's designed to boost your antibody response to the virus, meaning that as we get older, having had the chickenpox, if you have the chickenpox, whether it's a severe case or a mild case, the virus has entered your body. Your body clears it out, and as kids, you get chickenpox, it clears it out, but the problem is that it lies dormant. And that as long as your immune system has enough antibodies to suppress the resurgence of the virus, you don't have shingles. But you can get shingles at any time. My son's friend is 12 years old. He got shingles last week. I had a 16-year-old girl who came in last week as well with a 10-day history of a rash. And when you looked at it, it was definitely shingles. So it can happen at any age. The issue becomes one of preventing it for people who have had chickenpox. So the answer to the second question is, it doesn't matter if it's a mild or severe case of chickenpox. If you get chickenpox, you are at risk of developing shingles later on in life. In fact, the lifetime risk as you approach age 80, your lifetime risk of developing shingles is 1 in 2. So it's very, very common. The vaccine itself will boost those antibody levels that tend to diminish over time. And so it helps your body suppress the outbreak. The effectiveness of the vaccine is that about 70% of people, so 7 out of 10 people or 70 out of 100 people who receive the vaccine will be protected from recurrence of the virus or shingles. The remaining 30 out of 100 will have an incomplete response, meaning that if you do get shingles, it won't be as severe, meaning you won't have as much of a rash, you won't have as much pain, and the recovery time will be much better with much less likely chance of developing a condition that leads to a painful area over that skin, and that is called postherpetic neuralgia. Postherpetic simply means after the herpes infection. It's herpes zoster that's the virus. So after that infection, and neuralgia means nerve pain. So it's after that particular infection that gives you that nerve pain. So the vaccine itself is recommended because, as Rob can certainly attest to from all the calls that we get, we hear, and just this Sunday, Rob, I had a woman who called up who said that she developed shingles on her face and forehead. And she was saying, you know, I wish I would have had that vaccine. And I should declare I do not have any financial interest whatsoever from any company regarding the vaccine itself. I don't hold stock or shares of any company. I'm simply providing the information.
You haven't been on any junkets or anything like that?
I have not been on any junkets at all either.
Okay.
So it is a recommended vaccine primarily because of the reduction of morbidity that is associated with it.
Is it just one shot that you get?
Yeah, it's one shot. The optimum time, the initial research that was done showed that it was most effective for people over the age of 60, between the ages of 60 and 69. But nevertheless, it is available for people 50 years of age and over who wish to have it. It costs about $200. Some offices will have it in stock. It has to be kept at minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit in a refrigerator, so it has to be quite cold in the freezer. So it is not something that you can normally just buy in the pharmacy and bring over. You have only about 30 minutes after you mix it, reconstitute it, to use it. So it's usually provided on site when if you need to have it done.
Okay. Good luck, Alan. Let's move along to, is it Helen?
Helen? Yes.
Helen, go ahead.
Hello, Barry, Dr. Barry.
Hi.
On January 31st, I had bilateral meniscus surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Things are going really well. Just a couple of questions.
Sure.
At the incision sites, there seems to be, I don't know if it's scar tissue that's developed, so I sort of have hard bumps
Yep.
where the incisions are. So that's my first question. I've also been doing quite a bit of treadmill to get myself back up to par.
Yeah.
When can I start doing impact exercises? And what kind of exercising should I avoid right now?
Well, the bumps are just the way the skin is healing. So you're right that it is usually scar formation. It's something that will soften over time, but it's a normal progression of healing that you'll see in that area. So okay. There's not much to do about it. And how long ago did you have the surgery?
January 31st.
Okay, so we're now almost 8 weeks, mm-hmm. I would say. The treadmill is good. For meniscus, again, if it's just meniscus, then the treadmill that you're doing is fine. Impact, do you have a follow-up with your, are you being followed in terms of physical therapy or
no.
rehab or anything?
No. I was given a series of exercises to do by my surgeon,
yep.
so I've been doing those.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to start slowly building up on the treadmill week two after surgery, so I've been doing that.
Okay.
I'm up to an hour on the treadmill.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
No pain?
A little bit of discomfort, but I find that I have more discomfort, for example, if I'm in bed and then I get up
mm-hmm.
to go to the bathroom or something,
yeah,
the first
a bit
few
stiff,
steps.
Yeah, they're a bit
yeah.
stiff.
Yeah, but aside from that, no, it's been really good.
Okay, and what activities were you doing prior to the surgery? Which activities?
Lots. Aerobics,
mm-hmm.
step exercises, spinning.
Well, what
I'm fairly active.
Okay, so, and you haven't done spinning yet?
No.
Okay, so usually you want to do a stepwise approach just to gauge how well your knees respond. Ideally, high impact type of sports should be the last thing that you do,
okay.
Just because you don't want to, you know, you don't want to, you'll tend to find that the knees will still get a bit swollen from that type of exercise, especially so soon after the surgery. So
okay.
doing spinning would be a great idea. And then
okay.
you see what your knees do. If you, after spinning and the next day you find, you know, and these aren't too bad, then do that for a few weeks and then you start the light jogging and you do the slow impact stuff. But it's always a stepwise approach. So even if you're feeling great, you know, and you were doing whatever number of minutes in terms of jogging or running, really just do 5 or 10 minutes, then stop and then go home and see how you're responding. And you have to just listen to your body. It's unlikely that you're going to do too much more damage because things are relatively, after 8 weeks for meniscal repair, things are pretty much healed up. So
okay.
it's more just listening to your knees and letting them tell you whether you've pushed things too much. Even if you push a little bit too much and you get some pain afterwards, you're not reverting to your previous state. You're simply going to be aware of what the limitations are and then build up from there. But you should be able to resume a completely normal exercise regimen that you were doing before.
We're going to try and fit in either one or two calls. We'll see how long this one goes. Doris in Ottawa. Doris.
Yes, doctor.
Hi.
I would like to know what the principal cause of neuropathy.
Well, neuropathy is a general term. Neuropathy means damage to the nerves. And so there are different types of neuropathy. The most common ones are diabetic neuropathy, which is where the nerves in usually the feet and sometimes in the hands deteriorate and die. And they die because of lack of blood flow or circulation to feed the nerves. And that happens because when someone is diabetic, the blood vessels get blocked. It's called microvascular disease, micro meaning small, vascular referring to the arteries. They get blocked up and blood flow can't get to the nerves. The nerves start to die. You can't feel anything in the feet. Sometimes you get pain first and then you end up not being able to feel anything in your feet. And what's dangerous about that is that for many diabetics that have that, when they're walking, they can't feel if they've stepped on a stone or stubbed their toe. They end up with damage to the foot. Because diabetics don't heal very well, the foot gets further damaged. They have more ulcerations and they end up with very severe types of skin disease and damage. The other types of neuropathy you can have as a result of, we talked about this earlier, for shingles is a type of neuropathy where the nerves are damaged because of the infection that ensues from shingles. So those are common types of neuropathy that you see. So there are different diseases that can lead to this type of nerve damage. So depending on the location and depending on the disease entity that caused it, the treatment would follow based on what caused it in the first place.
I have this burning sensation in my lower legs,
mm-hmm.
and some, of course, in my feet, but I still have some feeling in my feet. It's just a burning sensation when I go to sleep. It's putting covers on, you know, you mm-hmm. kick the covers off and so on, and that's all I'm suffering from at the moment. But, of course, I did have vascular surgery done on my legs many years ago.
And so you
have varicose veins removed and so on.
Right. Has this been evaluated for you to see what's causing that nerve damage?
No, I've just mentioned that I had it, you know.
Okay.
And that's all that's happened so far.
So if you're, and it's in both legs?
Yes.
So what I would suggest is that when you see your physician, you're going to want, and your physician is most likely going to first check your blood pressure. He may want to find out what the circulation is like in your legs. He or she may want to check blood pressure, not only blood pressure, blood sugar, other disease processes that can cause compromised circulation to the legs. So those are the type of things that need to be evaluated. And it's not something that I would wait on, given that you're already having that kind of feeling where you have pain and but you still have some sensation. The last thing that you want to have happen, because this likely continues on a sort of on a spectrum, is that eventually you're going to lose feeling in the feet, and that's going to cause a whole bunch of problems, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Okay, Doris, we have to go. Okay. I want to fit in one more call. Good luck. And it's Daniel. Daniel.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good.
Fine, thanks.
All right. My problem is heartburn.
Mm-hmm.
I pop Tums like it's candy. But the real problem is, I think it's connected or not. In the mornings, I have all my yogurt, my banana. By 9:30, 10 o'clock, I eat my sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
When I eat my sandwich, it seems like in the middle of my stomach, it just jammed there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm chewing it fine. I'm not chewing like 52 times like you're supposed to, but it jams there, and it hurts. Sometimes it feels like I'm going to maybe...
Feel nauseated?
Nauseated. Not even nauseated. Just like a blackout's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And there's pain in there.
Okay. Well, let's find out.
So, if you're experiencing heartburn every day, then that's not a good thing. So, and popping Tums only neutralizes acid. It doesn't really deal with the problem. So ultimately, what needs to be evaluated is the cause of the acid in your stomach that's causing the heartburn. There's sometimes infections, something called H. pylori that can cause infections in the stomach that can lead to this problem. There's hiatus hernias, there's cigarette smoking, alcohol, caffeine intake. All those things contribute to more acid in the stomach. If you're feeling a blockage in there, this does require your physician to, first of all, get a history from you to see what's going on. And they may want to refer you to a gastroenterologist to actually look in the stomach to see if there is indeed something that's obstructing it.
So stop popping the Tums and go to the doctor.
You got
to
go and get that checked out. Yeah, because the Tums is only a Band-Aid.
Good to see you this
week.
Good
to see you, too.
Thanks for coming in.
My
Dr.
pleasure.
Barry Dworkin in the Wednesday House Call here on CFRA.